So have you abandoned the project?
No, I haven't abandoned it. I have managed to like print some demons. Like I got to number 24, and in 2007, I got to number 24, and I was like, all right, I'm a third of the way through. And then I have drawn about 36 of them, and I have printed about four more, I think, or five more than 24. So I'm up to like number 29 or something as far, because the thing is, these are screen prints. And so each one is a fine art print, and there's 150 of each of them that I print, and they're five colors. So they're very time consuming to do. And I have a very small following. I don't have people that are just busting down my door to buy my art. So basically it's a combination of fatigue, creative fatigue, and also literally not having enough money to be able to fund what I'm doing. What I started. I did it very impulsively, and I was working at a poster printing shop as a screen printer, so I had access to it to do this stuff. And I've had since another job where I had access to printing posters, so I was able to do it. And so then I moved to Maine a few years ago, and I'm in the process of finally having my own print shop, and I'm working on that right now in my garage. So my plan is to do it. Like I feel like I literally have had to carry, I have stacks and stacks of these prints. Like, you know, I don't know, must have a few thousand of them. And so anytime I've had to move, I've had to move them with me. Like they're a total pain in the ass.
Mm-hmm. Baggage.
Yeah. It's baggage. And it reminds me of like my father. Yeah. It's completely tied in with like, with procrastinating and not finishing what you start and all that other kind of stuff, you know, like that, maybe I'll never finish this project. And, you know, the thing is, it's like, looking back on it, I started the project 'cause I think I wanted attention, you know, like I wanted to do something artistically. Like I wanted to be mm-hmm. in the world. And I felt like, and it really was a pretty easy, it got me into the world like really fast committing to that project. Like I got in magazines and stuff and things that really fast. And,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because of the Crowley occult link,
I think that's part of it. I think like that's one part of it. I think, you know, I mean, it's funny 'cause I got invited to an OTO thing, actually like, 2008, I went to in Salem, Mass. I went to a big OTO gathering that was I sat like in the, they had like this kind of little vendor section where people sold like old Freemasonry aprons and, you know, DVDs of Crowley's weird plays, and with people doing these amateur kind of like neighborhood plays of Crowley plays, which are pretty funny. But people were not really, I just sat at a table just with my portfolio open showing the demons, and generally speaking, most people were not very interested in what I was doing. It felt kind of like a Trekkie convention. There was a lot of, you could just feel the kind of like awkward sexuality. You know, I saw up a guy's kilt at it. A guy flashed me. He was wearing a kilt and he crossed his legs in front of me and like very, very obviously to show his junk off. And, you know, the kind of, there was a person that had there was a woman who was selling these giant photographs of her vagina. Just that was two couple of the highlights of it, but most people weren't that interested in the prints. They kind of like thought, but I've met other people in the sort of, you know, esoterica, of who have esoteric interests that seem to like them. But the people that seem to like my prints the most, you know, are all different, that seem to be into the demons, you know. It's not just like occult oriented people.
And have you been following the Occult Yorkshire?
Yeah, I've been following it a little bit.
So you have a pretty good idea of where I stand on matters occult at this point.
I'm definitely interested in talking to you about that stuff.
I just found somebody for my Aleister Crowley cards because I realized I still had a deck, or rather, my wife took them out yesterday. I'd been thinking, do I still have a Crowley deck in the house? I should get rid of it. If I do, and then she'd pull them out because I'd given them to her, or I'd swapped them with her for her Rider-Waite deck anyway, and I just tweeted if anyone wants them because I don't want to burn them. I didn't want to burn them because one of the things I learned from my wife, I shouldn't say learned because it was it's hearsay, but she was with a guy for a while who was thought of himself as a shaman, and she had a Crowley deck back then, and she was trying to use them, and she felt that the readings were all off, and she mentioned it to him, and he said, "Oh, that's because I did a spell in this house that no entities can come in, and there's an entity attached to those cards." Which I don't find the least difficult to believe, and so I thought, well, I better not burn them because then maybe that means the entity will still hang around, kind of thing. Because it'd be somehow it'd be like bonding myself to the cards. But anyway, so I got an immediate response. That wasn't the point of the story, but
No, but
I've got somebody to send the cards to. But the point was is that. How I feel about those things at this point is that it's like a wart. You've got the surface and what's on the surface and the patterns and all the rest of it, but you can't just get rid of a wart by slicing it off or burning it off. You've got to get the roots out, and so these things have really deep roots, and the roots of occultism. I mean, I think this is maybe partly what you're addressing by talking about the degeneration of the symbols over time, but I'm not entirely sure. Maybe there was a time where they were pristine, but
I'm not sure that I agree with like that's what they were is something that's like this pure kind of thing or not, you know? It almost oh, sorry.
So to me, it's almost, and also you're saying you hope that they're not real, you hope that this stuff isn't real. Well, I know it's real in the sense that the effects are real. The effects of dabbling in this stuff are very real. That doesn't mean there's real entities out there that are autonomous or separate from the human psyche. But it does mean that there's something out there that is interacting with the human psyche. Is kind of intimately connected to the human psyche, just as archetypes are said to be. Doesn't mean that they're not products of the human psyche. Doesn't really matter. I mean, as far as the reality of the effects of, and of course, it's at base, it's working with symbols, stirring up things in one's unconscious. That's always risky. So even being creative at all, being self-expressive at all, working with paint, working with music, working with words, whatever it is, going to sleep at night is risky, because unconscious matter comes up, and it might be overwhelming to us. Certainly, taking psychedelics is more than risky, I'd say. But when you're talking about the occult or psychedelics, you really are adding an element of will and intent to it that makes it doubly risky. And I think that like the links that I've been tracking and mapping between occultism and intelligence and social control and sexual abuse of children, I think those links are absolutely fundamental. I think that there's so many and so profound that we're really talking about the same nexi or nexus, and the same drives behind it, the will to power, the will to control, and to pass on these poisons. So in your case, I'm talking to you, and I have felt some tension like from the start, and I wasn't sure, is this me? Am I just not really in the mood, or is it something else, or is it because of what we're talking about? And it may be all of the above, but I definitely think it includes what you're bringing in terms of this kind of legacy that comes from your father, but beyond, and how you're trying to resolve it through working with the occult. You're trying to dig out the wart. You're trying to get it at the roots and get it out. Because I'm doing that with Occult Yorkshire, I'm still putting my attention on these things. So I don't think it's about, my tendency is to say, my God, what are you doing? Get rid of that book. Why on earth would you want to be drawing demons? Why would, but on the other hand, somebody could say to me, well, why are you writing about these things? Why are you even thinking about them? Well, I don't have any choice. These qualities or these forces or whatever have embedded themselves into my life, and in order to disentangle myself from them, it seems I have to put my attention and explore them in a way that's creative. And so maybe that's what you're doing. I just say maybe. I mean, there's that possibility, and I presume that that's what you're hoping is going to be the outcome, rather than just making money and making a name for yourself, which of
Well,
course is,
that's the thing is that I think when I'm looking back on it, I'm trying to be as honest as possible about like what my 'cause like when people I don't, people attach artistic intent onto things like usually after the fact. I think like when they're describing like why they did something, they're like, I did this, because I wanted to show the juxtaposition between this thing and that thing and all this other stuff. But it's just because they have to explain it after. Like, I don't know how much how what my like the thing is I should actually like back up is like what when the original thing that brought me to working on the thing about the demon about working with the demons is as an intention, my intention has never been to gain was never really to gain power from working with them specifically, but like I didn't realize until late until looking back. I mean, I didn't think that way then. When I look back on it, I think I can be try to be more honest with myself and be like, no, you wanted to do something that would, maybe. Just something that you could say, I'm gonna do 72 of these things, and my initial idea was, and I actually started it out for almost 15 weeks. I was able to draw and print one of these things a week, which was I was on Prozac at the time too, by the way, when I made this commitment to doing the demon thing, and that was a whole nother thing, but I was able to just sort of to do it, and then I started losing my momentum. As far as the like the occult side of it goes, one of I really one of the things though that from the start that I do know was something that was at least an intention was I wanted to satirize these things basically. I wanted to depict these things as a like as a way to sort of almost like a political cartoon.
To break the spell.
Yeah. It was I never thought of it like it didn't ever intrigue me as like a in a Crowleyan kind of way of like that I'm gonna there's something savvy about this and there's something like sexy and like I'm gonna get like maybe that's my shadow talking or something that I wouldn't know otherwise, but like when I the reason why I was mentioning at the OTO gathering thing how people were generally not interested in my work, I felt kind of I felt validated by that. Like that's great because like they don't get it, and I was able to get into the heart of that and like see the people in the heart of that mix, and be like, God, none of this shit turns me on at all. You know, like it doesn't, you know, I mean, I don't want to hang out. I don't want to go to the banquet. I don't want to, I just want to go home. Like after this, this is like not, I don't care about any of these occult books. I don't care about any, like it didn't really, something about it wasn't, just really felt pointless. You know, and, but it felt, like I said, it felt like a Trekkie convention or something. And,
Right.
I just think like, with the, one of the things I've back come, come, I've come back and forth with the demons is like, it's just, am I don't, I feel like I got over to the other side basically. I, like, I don't feel as tortured by a lot of what I was being tortured by before. Like I feel like I like better than I used to feel when I like years ago. I can honestly say that. Like I don't I don't I still have some of the resonant leftover issues from some trauma that I've experienced, but I as a whole I'm not as crazy as I used to be. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Like you talk about, you know, I mean, you know, when you thought you were the one from the Matrix, you know, like I went through phases where I thought I was Pan, you know, or I thought I was
Right.
Merlin, you know, I was like, I'm definitely fucking Merlin. I'm Merlin, you know. I mean, that kind of stuff for, I don't, I, do you ever, are you ever afraid that you're gonna just fall into that kind of psychosis again, and you might just think that you're some other.
No. I think once you've been through it, you know what it is. I mean, it doesn't mean that inflation doesn't happen and so on and so forth, but there's the thing about once you've seen a delusion as a delusion, you can't, I mean, short of brain damage, amnesia, you can't forget what you've seen.
Right.
So, I mean, and one way of describing it is really learning not to trust, well, oneself in a sense. I mean, the constructed identity,
Yeah.
it's a gradual process, but there are certainly, it's a cumulative also, and so I would say, I would echo what you've been saying, is for myself also, that I've moved through some really difficult, like a labyrinth of projections and illusions, and while I by no means feel that I'm out the other side, I know that I'm through a whole bunch of stuff, and that it's behind me. I'm fully aware of it being behind me, and that whatever it was that was driving me into those delusions isn't driving me to the same extent. Like it's been integrated, or it's been dissolved, or however that process happens.
Yeah.
And so I'm closer to the original trauma, so I don't necessarily feel less. I mean, I feel more vulnerable than ever. So it's not as though I'm feeling more powerful or more confident.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just being feeling more relaxed and less driven, you know, less driven to prove things. So it's a very subtle thing. I'm trying to describe it now, and when you describe it, or you could describe it in was kind of in negative terms, as in I'm not as crazy as I once was, right?
Right.
So,
Yeah.
but I think that that's very intrinsic to the nature of integrating and becoming whole, is that it's not, there aren't any bells and whistles. There isn't much to talk about. It's just, yeah, I did that. I was there, and, and it was fun at the time. But okay, I don't believe in it anymore. And I think what you're touching on, or what we're touching on around the occult, is that it's a bit like the mountains and rivers. You know, first there are mountains, then there are no mountains, and then there are mountains again. So
Yeah.
initially the occult's not real, and then it becomes incredibly real, and you know it's real. And although you can never forget that you once found out that it was real, on the other side of that whole experience, it really isn't real after all. It's really it's there's an interface with our own consciousness with these symbols, and then we energize them and we make them real. But that isn't really that different from me and Clint Eastwood or David Byrne or David Bowie, these cultural figures that became as real to me as people I knew, but they weren't ever real. What was actually real was in the past, in terms of what happened to me that drove me to try and find an identity outside of my own soul, you know, my own my inner sense of my inner being, and to cobble it together, you know, because I couldn't become David Bowie, I couldn't become Clint Eastwood, and then I couldn't become Castaneda, Aleister Crowley, or Whitley Strieber. So I just kept adding new bits, and the identity got more and more kind of elaborate, more and more bells and whistles, until a certain point that it was this big Frankenstein's monster, really, and it was just like, I can't even move in this. You know, my reality's become so inflated that it had to burst, and it did burst. And then I was left in this very barren place of like, oh my God, Peggy Lee, this is all there is. It's just me and my social benefits and my daily routine, and it was pretty stark. And then from that point, you know, it's like the land was burnt, and the seeds were planted, even though I wasn't hardly aware that I had any seeds to plant at that point. But there was just a tiny handful left, you know, having recognized the folly of all the other grand plans I had. So,
Do you think, like, I mean, the as far as identity goes, and you know, hoping to, like, you with what you're doing now with Occult Yorkshire and with just the site in general and the podcast and everything, is the like is the open is the openness that you that you're engaging in, where you're letting people in on I don't know, you're sort of opening up your past, obviously, and like looking with your family into it, and is that does that help, do you think? Like, is that sort of, I mean, is that part of why you're over the over that abyss or whatever?
I think it's an indication that the fact that I'm able to do that is an indication of having let go of a great deal of the armor and the defenses and the masks and the crucial fictions, so that it is just me and it's just this wounded child. Not that I am that, but I mean the man that that I'm just becoming now is it's as if I'm picking up the development that was arrested way back then. So talking about that and being as vulnerable and as powerless in some way. I mean, I know there's also, I'm also being practical and efficient and doing a podcast and all the rest of it, and maybe even having some success. But the experience is much more like that child, really. I mean, like I'm still, it's almost like I'm closer to that past experience of distress and all the rest of it than I am, not to the present, but to the identity that's in the present, whatever that is. I mean, it's like, because it's undoing the identity that was created through the trauma, and what's left when that identity's gone, because the child self is integrated through that letting go of all the defenses. I mean, they go, they're congruent, like as I re-experience that early trauma and that helplessness, then I let go of the structures of identity, and as I let go of the structures of identity, I can re-experience more and embody more what wasn't able to be embodied. And then what's left, really? I mean, yes, there's a podcast and a blog, and but really there's just somebody living their life. And so yeah, that's to be intimate, to be able to be intimate and connect to people within that and from that, That seems to be the what's left if there isn't any persona that is trying to create a platform in the world. Like that, because that whole for decades that was my that's been my mission, is to create a persona, to perfect the persona that I, began creating in childhood, and in order that that persona can then build a platform and become a somebody in the world, in a nutshell, really, to be safe and above it all and powerful, to be the one. So, but once, as that drive dissolves, there really isn't anything left except being in the present and then connecting to others in a way that is as true as it can be, and that means being as vulnerable and as unhidden, unconcealed as possible. I don't know if this is answering your question or not. I think it is.
I think it is.
So, and it, but it is organic because, well, we'll see. Because I'm going back to Prisoner Infinity after Occult Yorkshire, which is less personal, because it's about Strieber and Kripal and these guys and the whole big picture. Not that Occult Yorkshire isn't, but anyway, Occult Yorkshire has been, it's been so organic in terms of, for me to understand my own past, I need to look at what's going on in the world and what's happened in the, in Britain throughout the 20th century. But also, in order to understand Jimmy Savile and social engineering, I need to bring in my own experience. And so that was this very organic relationship between the inner and the outer and the micro and the macrocosm, that it wasn't, there wasn't a conscious thing of, oh, I'm going to be more open now. There was just, oh, so this is happening now. Now I'm going to talk to my cousin, and now I'm going to put pictures of me as a child online. Am I really going to do that? I get in for a penny, in for a pound. And the thing is, my brother had done it before, in a bad way, I'd say, in a not healthy, healing way, including putting pictures of me as a child online and in his book, which I tried to revoke or fix, but I couldn't. So, I mean, that's just an example in terms of, well, it's already, there's already a whole, like my whole private life is already, not every detail, but still, the major elements of my private life has already been kind of sensationalized anyway by my brother. So if this is what it takes to set the record straight, and also maybe bring it back to this, what we're talking about, the occult is not really real. Well, the whole thing that I need, that I need to protect some part of myself from the world or from the forces of darkness, whatever, that's not really real either. Because, I needed protection back when I was a child. I didn't get it. Shit happened. It was it was pretty serious. But here I am now, and it's worked out. It worked out. And I don't need protection now. I really don't. I need water. I need electricity. I need a roof over my head. I need basic protection in order not in for with the elements. But I don't need protection from the forces of darkness. So, what am I afraid of? What really? What do I have to hide? It's kind of illusory. Not that I'm going to put it on Facebook. I mean, we could have some sort of principles, I think. Oh, it, the context is very important. Absolutely, the context. And bringing it back to your thing, just quickly, the awareness in which we do the thing is the key, right? So I wrote about movies in the 90s as Blood Poets, and I was candid and all the rest of it, but really it was all kind of wrapped up in the machinery of, this is my means to success, right? Whereas more recently I've been exploring it, and the awareness is very different. So I think with what you're doing, I think that that's the critical question, is like, how aware of you that this is a way for you to identify poisons in yourself, to use that word, things that have been implanted in you, and to by seeing them, to let go of them, to be able to actually dissolve them just through the act of seeing them.
time making sure she's found with no fishing line, just a washing line. I have to say it was worth the play to be making hay on a praying day. So I made my bed and I slept instead. I got overfed of where all that led. But I soon found out there was down about underneath the pout and the quivering snout. Either within you or without you. Either within you or without you. I'm without you. I'm without you. I sold you through all the me and yous and the bedroom blues and the kitchen stews. I have to say no days were grey, my feet were clay, but I slept okay. What got me down was the growing frown, the collective noun and the female hounds. I didn't mind, cause she was kind, though she was blind to the highway signs. Either within you or without you. Either within you or without you. I'm without you. I'm without you. So I drink my milk even though it's spilt, and the plows wilt over love that's killed. And I read my book, now I'm off the hook. I still like to look across the babbling brook. And I'm living fast, but what comes to pass is like passing gas, cause nothing ever lasts. You'll hear me say it's just another day. I've enjoyed my stay, but I'll be on my way. Either within you or without you. Either within you or without you. I'm without you. I'm without you.
I do think that that is what I've been doing, and I think that the problems that I've had with, you know, getting it done and with the things that, you know, the aspects of my life that fell apart here and there when I was in the thick of the negative times, it's like one of the reasons why, you know, I brought up the, you know, being open on the internet thing to you is that, like, you know, that's why I sent you my, to go back to the original email about the, you know, my first experience with pornography and bringing it all back to the pornography thing. So much of it is, it has been because of, for me is, to not, I didn't want anybody to know. I didn't want anybody to know what my, I was really trying to explain it efficiently, but the background or my life or something like pornography, you know, they're all sort of, it's almost like that's the occult. Like that's this thing, you know, trying to hide, like, I'm just trying to get at it a little bit. Like, with the email, when I'm being open with someone else and saying for me to contact someone, you know, I hear you on, you know, your podcast regularly, you listen to it pretty often. So you're a familiar voice, but to reach out and say to somebody, oh, you know, this is a story about my thing. I don't talk to people about that stuff very much, you know? And, but it seems like with my work that if I don't explain, if I don't talk about that sort of thing, then I won't be able to finish this work, because a lot of it is I need to finish this work. I have to finish this thing that I'm doing. And,
to you know, when you, I was inspired by you talking about going to brothels and just sort of being open about these experiences and being, I guess, not afraid. We're not afraid, but at least not having a shield when it comes to that, you know. Because and that was sort of, it's hard to spell it out, talking. I can't really explain it, but it's just there was an unlocking a little bit there where I was like this thing with talking about your sexuality, you know, and these things that someone would consider embarrassing, you know, like something you probably were embarrassed about, but now you can speak to it. I guess I'm kind of meandering trying to explain it, but it really is. It really has a lot to do with what I'm working on myself and the pornography and the sort of that dark zone of I mean, how did you? What do you? You don't have those kind of predilections anymore with the violence and women thing. That's sort of like something that is that is that did you have you driven that totally in like a it's dissolved fully or how like how does something like that integrate? Because I'm thinking about like you know people have certain I don't know how does
It
is it
doesn't
just
disappear.
disappear
I
for
mean,
you?
it's
You
still
don't
about
have you don't
poisons.
fall
Is
into
that
those sorts of
one
like
of the things I've
fantasies or anything like
observed?
that?
And because we're using language, so it's not literal, but that actually the assumption that I had that most people have is that you if you've got poisons in you, you want to get them out, you want to spew them out, detoxify, and be okay, but be cleansed. But what I think is my experience is. The opposite is that recognizing the poisons in oneself allows them to get released. It's like they get trapped in the body and then they get released and they get redistributed and then the body can absorb them. So the poisons get ingested. They get fully ingested by the body as opposed to sort of sectioned off where they actually can't do harm, but they remain concentrated. So they are doing harm. They are actually poisoning us. It's like they're in the blood anyway, but they're not getting distributed. I don't know. The metaphor's breaking down at this point. But okay. So then, what you were talking about earlier about expressing and how it, something came unlocked in you is also related, because what has been said is that secrets are toxic. When we keep something a secret, we trap it inside of us and it becomes toxic. So poisons relate to secrets. And of course, abuse is a secret. Not just if you do it, if you commit it, you're going to, of course, keep it a secret. But if it's done to you, most people keep it a secret, even from themselves. And that prevents it from being integrated into consciousness. It just remains shut away somewhere like a, unwanted child in the basement. So for me, a large part of the process has been speaking about things that are generally considered unspeakable and are uncomfortable and embarrassing and exposing, and therefore neutralizing them. So then, unseen or not seen was clearly a important step in that because you haven't read it, but it came out last this time last year, and it directly explores this predilection that I had and what was behind it. So in a way, the whole book is built around that my confession about that, and then it leads into my brother and Jimmy Savile, and so that led to Occult Yorkshire. So you could say, in some ways, like me. Fully identifying that complex in myself, in order to be able to speak about it and maybe not fully dissolve it, but certainly take significant steps towards dissolving it, has also made it possible for me to take my explorations deeper in terms of the kind of abuse that I may have suffered and what's going on in the world. So then. but that's ongoing. And then, so in terms of whether that propensity in myself is fully gone, and interestingly, somebody commented the blog just today, like, they thought the real danger that I had faced was becoming a perpetrator, and that it would be interesting for me to explore that. It was Anne Diamond, and I think that's true, and it's something I haven't talked or written about very much because of how sensitive it is. Like in Seen and Not Seen, well, I'm not talking about actually perpetrating. I'm just talking, not even talking about fantasies. Oh, right. I'm talking about, you know, scenes from movies that I found arousing, and of course that's uncomfortable enough to admit to that. To admit to having had those fantasies is mm-hmm. even more, and then to admit to actually having had those desires. Well, actually, I didn't ever have desires to be physically violent towards women, but not counting in relationship where I got triggered and I was really angry, but that wasn't the sadistic element to that. Not to say it wasn't part of the same complex, because of course it is. So what was I saying? Oh, in terms of it being fully gone, no. And one of the ways I observe it is in my dreams, my lucid dreams, and because I've throughout my life, those are where the fantasies have played out. I will have violent sexual fantasies, and so I'm able to observe that when I lucid dream. Sometimes I start indulging in those fantasies, and more I intervene. I say, okay, no, this is not a good idea. So this is me in the id. Of course, in my conscious ego self, I know that these aren't good things to indulge in, even at a fantasy level. But when I'm asleep and dreaming, that's the id. That's the part that generates the fantasies, where the poisons dwell, right? So at that level, even, there seems to be my consciousness is able to move more and more in the deeper levels, in the basements, and intervene and say, well, wait, no, this is not appropriate. This is not good behavior. But there's still, I won't say there's a battle raging. It doesn't feel like a battle, but there's still tension, and it can still go the other way too. There's still a part of me that wants to indulge them. So yeah, they're still there, but less and less and less. And so they're not really an issue to me. I'd say my compulsive nose picking is more of an issue at this point. But yeah, I mean, it's all part of everything. It's all part of, and also talking about that. I mean, just I think the more that we're able to talk about stuff openly, even publicly, the less of an issue it is, the less charged it is. Because we keep it like the poisons, we keep it charged by not letting anyone touch it, not letting anyone near it. Part of us wants that for ourselves. It's like the taboo thing, the excitement of the taboo that's hidden in the basement. And that, to bring it back to your thing, because I wanted to get into this, that activates the guardian. When we have a secret desire, secret pleasure, that also creates shame, we will indulge it, but then we activate the corresponding superego, which is the guardian, which says, no, this is wrong, you are bad, you must be punished again, because it was actually, I mean, this is the abuse is what mm-hmm. seizes us with those desires to begin with, but so it perpetuates itself. And so in your story, mm-hmm. this is what you've got. You've got this sexual peccadillo, this indulgement in forbidden sexual experience that is then followed by this extremely disproportionate punishment. And so what's behind that? Like, it's you're trying to dissolve something yourself. Clearly.
Oh, absolutely, totally. That's your interpretation of it is a good interpretation, because that is what I feel like I'm generally trying to do, you know, through the stories I'm generating and the artwork that I'm making. I mean, most of my stuff is describing sickness or dis-ease, you know, or you know, in a lot of the things, at least the narratives that I've been making, because I've been drawing these comics, a lot of these things are almost cautionary tales, like, in a way.
Well, that was what I found weird about the way you described the story, because it sounded almost as though you were writing a cautionary tale, which could be interpreted as that this is what you'll get if you indulge in those devious desires. Something really horrible will happen to you, so don't go there. It could be interpreted in that kind of very ultra Christian cautionary tale as any kind of sexual deviance, and you will burn in hell, right?
Yeah. They, I mean, a lot of the stuff I've been doing is around those themes of how cautionary, of those extreme cautionary tales. I mean, like, sort of like, you know, eternal damnation or, you know, punishment. But at least these, I mean, I've been doing a series of these 3-page ones that, and it's sort of like a ongoing theme, you know, of like someone doing something, getting themselves into trouble, and then something bad happens to them, you know.
You deliberately exaggerate it.
Yeah. And it's sort of almost like a gag. It's because I'm doing them. It's almost like, you know, Mad Magazine Mad Magazine, but, you know, it's just this kind of gag, over the top, gaggy kind of thing. But like, I mean, embedded in it a lot of times are, you know, crucifixions and upside down crosses and things like that. So there is a little bit of it for me is making fun of I'm trying to kind of make fun of the Jack Chick comics type things, like those sort of, you know, real hellfire and brimstone Christian
right
methods, not necessarily the medium exactly, because my family is like all Irish Catholic, so I mean, I wasn't brought up Catholic, but and I wasn't even baptized, but I still have, you know, there is a Judeo-Christian framework to some aspect of my, you know, my critical factor that I possess, you know.
Sure.
You know, I tend to probably run things through that. I try not to. I've gone through phases where I've identified, you know, more pagan aspects of my nature, or try to at least, but you know, that comes out for me, it comes out in a very heathen kind of way. It's still very like, you know, fuck Christianity, you know. So it's obvious that, you know, I'm definitely running it through that filter. At least, you know, at least my own, if I'm punishing myself in any way, it's going to be sort of probably to that extent that, you know, you're demonized and you're going to burn in hell kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say, go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
Well, I didn't necessarily have a fully formed thought.
I'm just really, it's the, with the occult thing and with the comics and everything that I've been doing, I mean, to tell you the truth, like, honestly, part of me has been, I mean, it's not really with the demon thing, not really the occult thing. I have actively felt like for a number of years, like I've been sort of like trapped in a particular sort of, realm, where I'm only interested in sort of exposing ugliness and sort of poor choices and drug abuse, and sort of like I've been doing the scuzzy artwork for a certain number of years, and like I know that so much of it is has pretty deep ties to trauma at this point, and like I don't know exactly how at this point I'm when I think about when I think about all this, what you were talking about with child abuse or potential or with pedophiles and with my father and with your occult Yorkshire and all this other stuff, I just wonder how much it's like the chicken and egg type thing. Like, I don't know. Is a lot of this occult stuff generated out of people's refusal to or inability to see the shadow, or is it a feedback loop that's happening between? I mean, you said, you know, Video Nasties sort of inspired you, you know, initially, you know, what you wouldn't have had that inclination towards violence in women, but like. Weren't Video Nasties like a, wouldn't that be a modern occult? Wouldn't that have been an example of like kind of modern occult because somebody, you know, somebody branded something like taboo?
Sure. I'm sure that was a big part of why I was drawn to Crowley and the occult and why many, many people are, because it's taboo. So that reinforces the attraction of it, intensifies it. It's that charged thing again. It's charged because it's kept secret, it's kept hidden.
So like, sort of just like, you know, if you were to think about that period of time, like when Video Nasties were this occult, these occult things that you weren't allowed to have access to, but you can have it, but you do have access to, like, that's the thing, like, it's hidden, but it's hidden just, like, enough that you can still find it. And I mean, what the true occult is would be some. Is the true occult what's truly hidden, or is it what is kind of hidden just enough for you to get it if you're curious enough? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the question I have about it. Like, is there actually a real occult? Is there something that's really? I mean, we wouldn't know, but it seems.
Well, it's the unconscious, of course. So we know that there's stuff hidden from us because we don't remember it. We don't remember our births. We don't remember most of what we dream every night. So is that hidden or is it forgotten? I mean, it's kind of a mystery there, but we want to go there. We want to know what's there because that's to be whole. I mean, it's a literalized kind of version of being whole, we used to be able to remember everything that's happened to us while we've been in this body or embodied, you know, this biological organism. Everything that's happened to it, I want to have total access to that, to all the hard drives. But what is it that wants that? Well, it's the conscious identity, which is a constructed identity anyway. It's a false identity that can only exist based on the suppression of that matter that allows it to be defined as separate from our soul, the totality of what we are. So to actually access the full, you know, data drive would be the dissolution of the self, the conscious self, into the unconscious. But I imagine it would also entail a kind of realization that nothing had ever been hidden. That, I mean, we'd hidden ourselves from ourselves. Now it's
right.
What's occult in that? What's actually hidden? There's a kind of flip over because what we think of as our conscious self or the real self turns out to be basically unconscious of the larger reality that we have identified as unconscious. So I think similar with the occult is that it's besides the structures of control and suppression and secrecy that create you know, an occult base of power in order to control people, besides all of that, the idea of the occult is illusory. It's not really hidden. There's nothing really hidden from us,
right? So that's why it's easy to find when you go looking for it.
Well, because it's everywhere,
right? Well, I mean, that's the thing. We get back to the porno thing when I was talking about. There's so many people that are out there that are looking at porn all the time. I mean, it's something that is you can probably, as an example, like you could go, they have those, you could probably go and find any given minute there's going to be somebody out there that is looking at pornography somewhere, and they don't want anybody to know that they're doing it, and they're hiding and they're actively not allow it's something that I'm just wondering how much is pornography a form of the occult in this modern age?
Well, it's back to taboo, isn't it? The whole thing about taboo and how it's a tough one. It's so huge. Like a whole civilization or society, culture, is built on taboo, because it's like the macrocosm of the constructed identity. It can only exist by disowning and disidentifying and suppressing the majority of experience.
Mm-hmm.
So society is this structure that that depends on keeping the barbarian hordes outside the walls. It depends on keeping the id at bay. And taboo is how that is done. You create taboos. These are things that can't be said. These are things that can't be expressed. It's like the gargoyles outside the church, right? They keep the structure intact by keeping out of awareness everything that that would threaten the structure. It's a bit of a circular thing, because the structure can only be wouldn't exist if it didn't have to protect itself. It's bizarre. Like, what's it protecting? The structure is it's a structure of protection that exists to protect itself. So mm-hmm. It's very confusing to talk about. And then the whole thing around sexuality, and because sexuality is a taboo, and we're instilled with this sense of sin around sexuality and shame, because that there's something wrong about it, then there's this corresponding self-punishing aspect of us that kicks in when we feel very strong sexual desire, and then that in extreme cases, that self-punishing thing itself becomes a form of distorted sexual expression. So it's like in Psycho or Dress to Kill, the stronger this person's desire becomes for the object, the more the internal accuser kicks in and says, this is forbidden, and then that internal reaction against desire takes over the person who experienced the desire, and then that person kills the object of desire. That's the narrative in Psycho and Dress to Kill. And that's what we're describing here. We've been talking around it various different ways, and in your story in the basement, he's just got this little bit of desire, and then it invokes this horrendous punishing figure, and it's a kind of pornographic narrative. I mean, the narrative of him being punished in your story, eaten by rats, mm-hmm. is more pornographic than what the boy was up to and whatever he discovered, really, mm-hmm. or at least mm-hmm. as, and that's in your first experience. You discover pornography, and then you see this horrific image of a woman being staked.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you've got the simultaneity of sexual desire with ferocious punishing violence.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking forward to talking to you about this because, you know, I was interested in hearing you because I had a feeling you could weave some of this together a little bit.
Well, just a little bit. I mean, it's timely for me also on challenging, and there's an opportunity in it because it's new and old to me. I mean, it's old because of what we've been talking about. It's been, this complex has been with me since adolescence. But in terms of really seeing it for what it is and understanding it and dissolving it, that's still ongoing. And it's very, very difficult to talk about, even though we know many, there's been plenty of talk about the correlation between sex and violence, sadism, you know, but how does that relationship actually work? How does that happen? Is not talked about, and it's not really understood. And yeah, so people with porn, I'm just going to leave it at that because I'm still groping around it. But as I said at the beginning, it's a spectrum. It's not sexual violence or straight pornography. They're a spectrum because as soon as you begin to feel shame around sexuality, and which is as soon as sexual expression is uncoupled from intimacy and love, then there's a shame around it. Yeah. And then, not to say that it might not be with intimacy and love either, actually, but it gets uncoupled early on. There's a lot of background noise, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry. There we go. Alright, is that better?
That was like a sound effect from a horror movie.
Yeah, because I live in Maine, and I was trying to really slowly open and close the door to the stove to put a log on the fire.
All right, nice.
I'm very rustic. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, so it's just it's a really big ball of wax. And for me, a lot of it, I can trace a lot of it to my brother, as with so many things, that he used to get those horror comics, and he also loved Hammer Horror, and his bedroom wall was covered with images from Hammer Horror movies.
Oh, wow.
And I used to go through that bedroom because there was a playroom on the other side with my friend, and it was always a terrifying experience, but an exciting and exhilarating experience as well to go through that room.
Yeah.
Like a what?
Like a gauntlet. Like
Yeah. Exactly. We would run through it. And all of these horrific images, these taboo images of murder and mayhem and monsters, mutilation. And that, I mean, that seems to have, again, because it was taboo, there was something forbidden about horror movies, and that's the occult. They became sexually exciting to me, and I wasn't aware of it at that time. I was pre-adolescent, but I do remember how exciting it was to get to watch a movie when I was eight. I mean, a horror movie, Prince of Darkness, I would have been about eight. I was woken up for my birthday to be able to watch it. The fact I cared means I must have picked it up from my brother, otherwise why would I care about Christopher Lee horror movie?
Sure.
And of course my brother he was modeling male sexuality for me, not in a good way. I mean, he was violent towards me, so it wasn't good in that way, but in other ways, I don't know. But he was sexually active at 12, so he would have been, some part of me would have known. So that would have been my imprint of sexuality, I think, because my father wasn't even around at that point. Could have been my stepfather, but I have a feeling it was more my brother. I'd have been more identified with him. So I think the two got kind of tangled up in some way, because I identified with his love of horror movies and the excitement around horror movies. And yeah, and so, and of course a lot of those horror movies did have, you know, big buxom women heaving bosoms and it's a bit of sexualized violence. They're pretty tame compared to now. But then that's also a way to see how this has evolved and become more overt and more tangible. Torture porn, and I don't watch torture porn. I mean, I hate it, but I've seen one. I saw Hostel, and yeah, I was just appalled by it.
I looked at a Serbian movie, I think, or a Serbian film, I think it's called. It's some torture porn movie. And it's I saw a couple of the Saw movies in the theater with my nephew when I was young, 10 years ago or something. But it's way more over the top than anything that would have been around during, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's surprisingly. I fast forwarded to see what these scenes were, you know, and it's like, it's everything. It's as bad as it can get, basically. Like that I'm sure that they could get away with. I imagine that's what their whole point is to be provocative, I guess. That's my whole thing is like, what's the intention behind making these things? Like, is it a response to what people want, or is it because they want to give something to people that will program them to want more of it?
Well, they're also giving to themselves what they want. They're making their own porn and then marketing it. And so, I mean, that's good marketing, right?
You
figure out what you like and then you give it to everyone else, right?
Well, would that be that guy Eli Roth? Is that the guy that made Hostel?
Yeah.
Because I have one of his. I have a book of some of his artwork or something that somebody gave me. Or it's not artwork of his, but it's stuff that is. It's some Eli Roth book. I never watched Hostel or like I said, I just saw some of that Serbian film thing. And, generally speaking, it seems to be have you ever heard of, this is connected to what I do, cartooning and stuff, but have you ever heard of Mike Diana?
No.
He's a cartoonist. He lives in New York, and he back in the early 1990s got in a lot of trouble in Florida for drawing blasphemous comics, and was the first and only cartoonist to ever be jailed for drawing blasphemous cartoons in the United States. And he at the time, the story is really interesting, because at the time there was a serial killer in the area, and they were trying to suggest that he may be the serial killer, among other things, because of the content of his drawings.
Right.
A lot of it was stuff that involved, like, bestiality, pedophilia, like really blasphemous nuns being, you know, flayed. I mean, you name it. And but it wasn't like Hostel or it wasn't in that. I'm not comparing it to those kind of things. It was, you'd have to see it, really. I guess you can look it up on the internet. But he just often talked about how the reason why he drew what he drew was in order to deal with this, what he read about, because he would read about stories of people, you know, he read something in the paper, you know, about some a child that was killed, people that, you know, killed a kid or something, and it was his way of sort of dealing with the horror of it. And I wonder, you know, like, he's an underground comic artist, you know, he was associated with, like, death metal bands and things like that. He wasn't like Eli Roth, you know. I wonder, like, with the kind of the difference between, as far as, like, artists go, people that are depicting, you know, very horrific kind of inhuman type stuff. In the case of Mike Diana, he was doing it in a cartoon form, just sort of almost like, pornographic comics almost. But in the case of you know, the film, the medium of film, which is similar to comics, because they're both kind of like, a comic is almost like a storyboard for a film, and mm-hmm. and I wonder when I was, you know, how much the medium of, like, film being something that can really give someone quite a lot of power as a director. Like, it gives you a real established identity where you can, like, tell people what to do all the time, and you can be, like, a huge prick. And, you know, I wonder, you know, when is there a difference between I'm not trying to make a character judgment on Eli Roth or anything like that, but, like, you know, is someone like, are they both healthy? I shouldn't say healthy, but are they both expressions of I feel like someone like Eli Roth is doing it because he thinks he's going to get attention for it. Like, I don't, someone like Mike Diana, the comic artist, I felt like he really was, from at least my standpoint, is generating it out of a legitimate, like, kind of inner child trying to, like, deal with these horrible visions that he has, because his stuff was kind of crude and childlike sometimes.
Well, that's possible. I mean, victims of satanic ritual abuse as children often draw, you know, the experiences they've had, they will end up drawing them, the abuse, and presumably that is an attempt to somehow process it. So, and of course, our, you know, the creative process is potentially well known to be potentially cathartic as a way to work stuff out. And I don't think anyone who's really immersed in creativity isn't in some way trying to resolve something in their unconscious one way or another. So there is that always, and so that would even apply with Eli Roth or Quentin Tarantino to some degree. But then, so then there's the level of awareness and how aware they are, and how aware we are means how, determines how responsible we are, and vice versa. If an artist is clearly not being responsible, then they're clearly not aware. Like Tarantino, although I watch his movies, he wants to make violence look fun, essentially. He just loves violence, and okay, I can relate to that. That's how I was when I was 15. But he's not. He seems to be completely unaware, or choosing to ignore, how irresponsible that is, potentially, in terms of making violence fun, just as an idea. He seems to think that there's a complete separation between what goes on in a movie and what goes on in the world, which is absurd to my mind. It's all a continuum, right?
I was thinking, I mean, just in general, the effect of someone like Tarantino, or the effect of someone like Eli Roth or whatever, like, on culture, where, like, you know, a kid like can be so, you know, a kid who's not quite all there can go into a high school or go somewhere and start shooting everybody up or whatever. Like, that phenomenon of that guy, Mike Diana, for example, like the cartoonist, when one of the things they gave him that they tried to suggest when they were trying him for drawing blasphemous cartoons was that the work that they had a psychologist actually say this, that the work he was making was intended for people who are psychopaths and who are serial killers and things like that. Like, they were trying to prove that he did this on this stuff in order to sort of, like, and it was during this sort of post-satanic panic spell and stuff, but, like, I wonder, you know, how much, I'm not saying that Mike Diana or Eli Roth or any people do have the intent, but do you think that, I mean, if you're getting into the, like, cultural programming thing, is it possible that, like, it is the intent, but they don't, you know, like, the intent is to create people that will be triggered by it, like, through repeated conditioning?
I think when you're talking about intent or intentions, then you're talking about conscious, something that's conscious, and it becomes very speculative. I mean, certainly I would be very surprised if it was the conscious intentions of any of these people that we've named. I think they're just irresponsible and unaware. And I think it's kind of irrelevant. I think when you've got a culture that has created in such a way that there's a particular shape to that culture, and that in order to get ahead and be successful in that culture, you have to match, you have to fit with the shape of the culture, you have to imitate it. And so then that creates that, I think you use the term, a feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
So certain behaviors get rewarded, then those behaviors proliferate more, the culture becomes more and more embedded or informed by those behaviors, and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
It just keeps intensifying.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking about these sorts of things, well, if Eli Roth were going to attempt to really explore his own trauma and his own experiences of violence, that would be a much more uncomfortable experience for him, so he's going to be disinclined to take that route anyway. But also the result would be a lot less marketable, a lot less appealing to others. So there's a kind of just natural selection that goes on there at the individual and at the cultural level, that it's the kind of material that actually makes it fun. As Tarantino said, in his lexicon, you want to make violence fun because he wants to make a movie that's entertaining and that's violent. And so, yeah, he doesn't want people to come out traumatized. But that's the, well, I mean, it just isn't fun, right? It's totally inauthentic.
Yeah.
A movie or an artistic expression that makes violence fun, the only way for that to represent something authentic is if it's representing the experience and the perception of a sociopathic sadist who enjoys violence, right? That's the only equivalent in reality, right?
Yeah.
So then they naturally align with that without even intending to.
Right, because it's created a norm.
Well, it does create a norm. Yeah, that's right. It gets normalized, so they're not even aware. They're thinking, no, I'm just having fun. It's just fun.
Yeah.
It's not real. Mm-hmm. But it's not real to the psychopaths who commit it either. They're dissociated.
Right.
And that's part of why they're committing these hideous acts, is because they can't feel real. Right? It's a terrible, that's a terrible feedback loop in itself. You know? The more violence, the more dissociation, the more dissociated you become, the more you need to feel real through acts of violence.
And with the, I mean, I don't really watch a lot, I don't pay attention to a lot of modern TV and things like that, but I'm aware of that there are a lot of main protagonists that are psychopaths.
You could say that the hero, the Bruce Willis and
formerly
Clint Eastwood and Charles Bronson, if you were to transpose them into real life, into one's own life, they wouldn't be heroic. They're brutal men. The only reason they're heroic is because there are even more brutal men that they're busy destroying and eradicating. So then within the nihilistic dream world of the movie, they are heroes, but if they were transposed into our reality, they would be wife-beating thugs or worse,
mm-hmm.
I guess, mm-hmm. or husband-beating. I don't want to demonize the male here, having discovered as much as I have, but about that can of worms.
So, I mean, in the case of, just go back, just to bring it all back to the beginning of the shaman porn thing, or whatever, as a means of if you're in terms of my own existence and my own brain traumas, I've had multiple injuries, things like that, trauma in general, and working within these realms, like with demonology or other aspects of those sort of shadow ideas, the question, I'm just wondering, what we're kind of trying to get at a question for you is, I just wonder how much of what I'm trying to get through is a positive or a negative thing. Like, I can't know until it's over, until it's done or whatever, but like with the working on the demon prints, like I've been doing, like has been, does that process end, or is it always just, I mean, you seem to have been through those sort of like coming and going things a lot with new identities and stuff like that, like new monikers and things. You've integrated it into yourself and it's dissolved this shadow. With what I'm doing, it seems that it has to happen. I have to finish the series in order to know whether it's dissolved and been integrated or not. And the realness of entities, those infernal kind of dark entities that are out there, it's confirmed, but once you see it and you identify it and it's gone, I mean, it disappears once it's confirmed, basically. Like with each of these demons that I've worked on, I look back at each one of them and they look different to me every single time. It looks I don't remember when I drew it, or I think it's something. So really, it's hard. It's difficult to express myself at this point. It's pretty much what it comes down to with it. Like I.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was going to be a question, but yeah, I guess you were not able to. But I think I got what the question is, and I think it's a really good question, and that the best questions, asking them is more important than getting the answer. So it's the kind of question that it's better for me not to answer anyway. I mean, certainly I'm saying that now because we've been on for 3 hours. So.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm also saying it because it's true, because you're questioning something that is between you and your own, I won't say conscience, although there is that element between you and your own unconscious. Right?
Well, that's the reason why, I can't even formulate the question.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world come tumbling down.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your prayer. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his world came tumbling down. His mind. Out here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Out here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La vie dans la jungle sec. Sur les sabres prépare.